Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. This episode's guest is Craig Johnson, author of the Walt Longmire series of crime fiction novels, the most recent of which, An Obvious Fact, is being released on Tuesday, September 13th. Les Klinger and I couldn't really not speak to Craig because at the beginning of An Obvious Fact, which takes place against the backdrop of the Sturgis motorcycle rally, we learn that Henry Standing Bear has brought along the two-volume set of The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, The Complete Short Stories, by none other than Les, the co-host of Speaking of Mysteries. Here's Craig Johnson.
Well, welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. This is a podcast that I think, Nancy, we're about to hit 100.
We're about to hit 100, yes, 100 episodes.
This is so far a really high paying hobby for Nancy and myself. Basically, what we try to do is have friends who are in the mystery world come on the show and talk about their books and their writing life and things like that. And so the questions are all softballs. We're delighted, Craig, to have you on the show. Craig Johnson, author of many stories, primarily known for the Longmire mystery series. And we want to talk about that and how that came to be. And we want to talk about your experiences in television land. I'd like to go back to the basics, Craig, which is, how did you get here? I mean, what made you pick up a pen or typewriter or whatever it is that you started with?
Well, that question has a supposition that I've arrived. I don't know if that's quite the case yet.
Well, you haven't necessarily arrived, but you're here.
I am here.
You are where you are at the moment. How did you get?
I am. In New Cross, Wyoming, population 25. I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, the big questions are always like, you know, how'd you become a writer? There are only two honest answers to that. The first one is you stumble across a storyline that you think is, you know, worth telling, that might be something that's a little bit different from everything that's out there. And then you kind of run out of excuses also, because you can excuse yourself right into the grave and never having written a sentence. And so for me, it kind of came down to the fact that I had this idea, you know, about a young woman with fetal alcohol syndrome on the reservation who was taken into a basement and abused by these young men who were slowly but surely being taken out with this 45-70 Sharps Buffalo rifle. And I thought that the story had something to say about race relations and the contemporary American West and, you know, a lot of different things like that. And at that point in time, this was like about, you know, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, that was when the CSI stuff was really starting to come into its own. And everything I read, everything that I saw on television, you know, movies, everything was all about the technology. It was all about, you know, the forensics, the ballistics, the DNA, you know, studies and all of this. And I just thought, you know what, that sounds a little, you know, not right. And so I asked the DCI investigator at one point here in Wyoming. I asked him, I said, you know, how long does it take you to get DNA evidence? Like, and we have one crime lab in the entire state of Wyoming. And he said, about 9 months. And I was like, okay, so that's not really particularly honest what they're doing with all this technology, is it? And he goes, no, it's not, not at all. And, like, and he said, it may be different, you know, with the NYPD or the LAPD or something like that. He said, but, you know, you've got to have the equipment. You've got to have the people to run the equipment. You know, you have to have the money, you know. And he said, you know, an awful lot of the times in rural law enforcement, you don't have those luxuries. And so I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, okay, because it seemed to me that the technology was kind of robbing a lot of the writing of what I consider to be the better part, which is, you know, character and place. And so I thought, okay, well, what if you did a procedural that took place in the least populated county in the least populated state in America? That would kind of force you, you know, to delve in the fields of, you know, character and place, which is where I think the best writing is done. And that's kind of how Walt Longmire came to be. And the first book, The Cold Dish, was the first novel in the series. And it was actually supposed to be just a standalone book. It wasn't even really supposed to be a series of books. And I wrote the first one and was fortunate enough to get it picked up by Viking Penguin. And Catherine Court, you know, who's the president of Penguin, sat me down and she said, you know, we'd really like you to think about maybe doing some more of these. And I told her, I'm happy to write you guys some more books. And she said, no, I don't think you understand. We'd like some more of these. We think these characters, these relationships, this place, you know, people are going to want more of this. And that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published started arguing with the president of Penguin USA and going, oh, I don't think that'll work. I don't think it's a good idea. But I got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you. And she said, why don't you go back to your ranch in Wyoming and think about this? So I did.
I was going to say, this is the trap that, you know...
Well, you know, and the big question was, okay, well, do these characters have more stories to tell like that? And, you know, and I thought, okay, yeah, they probably do, and nobody else is going to be writing them, you dummy. So if you're going to do this, you know, if it's going to get done, you probably need to sit down and get started doing it. And that's how the whole series kind of came to be.
Well, you know, the publishers basically, and frankly, to some extent, readers, they like exactly the same as the first book, just different.
And that's a difficult situation to be in. I mean, I think one of the things that you strive for is for each book to be different. You know, that you try and find a different way to play them up each time, like that. And and you can become a victim of your own success. A lot of times the publisher and the reading public sometimes they really love this one big breakout book. Well, then you're supposed to rewrite that book over and over and over again. And
exactly,
boy, for any kind of artistic sensibility, that's pretty much death. So have to strike a balance.
Well, one of my favorite questions to ask for writers of successful series is, what are you sorry about now that you put into one of the early books that you're sort of stuck with now?
I don't know. I mean, I've been fortunate enough that most of the big mistakes that I made turned out to be benefits, in the long term. I mean, there are a lot of people that give you advice when you're first starting out. And the thing I laugh about is, a lot of beginning mystery authors get a lot of advice from other mystery authors that are a little bit further down the trail. And some of the advice that I got, one was, don't give your protagonist any pets.
Right.
Because, then you've got to take care of those pets and you have to deal with them and all of this, and you'll mess up and people will be angry and all this. The only thing I could think was, I've got a whole ranch full of animals that I have to take care of. I don't see why Walt can't take care of one dog. And it actually opened up and made for a lot of opportunities in the books, because in essence, I'm pretty much writing about an armed man who drives around Wyoming, solving these crimes like that. And I thought, okay, well, I can either have him talk to himself or I can have him talk to the dog. And to be honest with you, people who are armed and talk to themselves kind of worry me. I don't know about you guys, It gave me a little bit more of an opportunity to have him, have more of a stream of consciousness and be able to talk to the dog. And the dog actually has now turned out to be, one of the major characters in the books. I get two kinds of emails after every book. One is, you beat up on Walt too much in the last book, you need to take it easy on him in the next one. And the other one is, there was not enough of my favorite character in the last book, because there's kind of an ebb and a flow of the characters, no matter, which book it is. And I knew I'd reached a certain point, because people will write and say, well, there wasn't enough Henry, there wasn't enough Vic, there wasn't enough Lucian. And I knew I'd reached a certain point whenever people were writing and saying, there really wasn't enough dog in the last book. Well, it's one of those things that was going to be a problem, but actually turned out to be a good thing in the long run.
So were you a devoted mystery reader before you started writing?
I was, but only in the kind of the classical sense. You'll probably appreciate this, because it's your interest too. I didn't read a lot of contemporary crime fiction, but I read, that golden era, of crime fiction, which was, obviously the Arthur Conan Doyles, the Agatha Christies, the Dorothy Sayers, the Raymond Chandlers, the Dashiell Hammetts, all of those, because there is a little bit of a proof in time, in the sense that, that these are still writers who are still, they're still relevant today, because the quality of their writing is so good, that they've kind of made that transition, being from simply, crime fiction into being, absolute literature.
Yes.
And, I read a lot of those, when I was growing up, and even still continue to go back to some of those writers today. The book that I'm writing now, that won't be out till next year, is actually called The Western Star. And what happens in it, of course, is we kind of harken back to a period in time when Walt Longmire is first hired by Lucian Conley back in 1972. And the premise of the book is that the Wyoming Sheriff's Association's annual meeting from 1948 to 1972 was held on a train that went all the way from across Wyoming and back, from Cheyenne to Evanston and back. And one of the younger sheriffs looks at Walt and says, 24 armed sheriffs on a train. And Walt looks at him and says, when we started. And, of course, the paperback, you know, that Walt is carrying in his back pocket throughout that entire book is a copy of Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express. You know, so it's always a chance, you know, for me to kind of harken back, you know, to a level of crime fiction that I think is truly elevated.
Walt
is trying to write these books. He's pretty well read like that. And so for me, it's one of the joys, you know, that he kind of has that in common, you know, with the readership of the books. And but it also it provides other layers, I think, you know, to the books and gives you an opportunity to advance that.
Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't point out to every one of our listeners that they not only does is he well read, he actually has a copy of my new annotated Sherlock Holmes, apparently.
And he brings it.
Wait a minute, was that a blatant plug I just heard? Was that what that was? I'm not sure.
It was a plug for your book.
And Henry,
well, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Brings it.
Well, it was kind of funny like that because I had this, you know, this book in mind like it, and it's an interesting, it's a very straight ahead, you know, procedural kind of mystery novel, An Obvious Fact, that's coming out here, you know, I guess next week, like on September 13th. And it was an interesting book in the sense that, you know, the setting for the book is a little town up in northeastern Wyoming called Hewlett, which has a population of 396 and a police force of one. And which is actually pretty good odds, you know, when you look at the crime statistics, you know, on the high plains, you know, the ratio is pretty good, 400 citizens per police officer. But once a year, the little town of Hewlett has a sister city over in South Dakota called Sturgis, that has the largest motorcycle rally in the world. And just last year, their 75th rally had over 1 million bikers. And about 50,000 of those bikers tend to peel off and go over into Wyoming and through the little town of Hewlett simply because it sits at the base of the first national monument in the United States, Devil's Tower. And so I thought to myself, okay, you know, a town of 396 with only one police officer and 50,000 bikers in it, that's probably something that Walt and Henry and Vic need to be involved with. And since it was, you know, such a quintessential, you know, kind of mystery, I thought to myself, you know, I probably need some underpinnings for this. You know, I need some underpinnings, you know, some literary underpinnings for this. And so what happens, of course, is that as they're getting ready to leave Walt's house to go over to Hewlett, Henry, you know, spots the annotated, you know, Sherlock Holmes, you know, short stories and reaches over and plucks that out of Walt's bookcases and takes it with him. And throughout the entire book is quoting Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes to poor Walt, you know, and there's nothing worse than having the world's greatest detective quoted to you as you're trying to work your way through a murder mystery.
Exactly.
You know, poor Walt, you know, gets kind of beat up by the end of the book. Like, there are numerous times where he turns to Henry and says, why don't you and Sherlock Holmes shut the hell up? And it's a fun book to work with. Well, I had to have the proper book for him to steal out of Walt's bookcase. And the first one that I thought of was Leslie's book. I thought, this is the one. This will be it.
I'm just wondering where Henry put the books, because they're I'm looking at them right now. They're not small.
Well, no, they're not. Okay, but fortunately, both Henry and Walt are very large men, like that. So you know, carrying those books around is not that much of a problem, like that. But yeah, the very first page in the book, Walt is kneeling down beside a highway where there's been an accident, but we're not quite sure if it was an accident. There's a young man whose motorcycle was run off the road, who's been hurt, and you know, the little town police department kind of calls Walt up and says, hey, could you come over and take a look at this? And so he's kneeling down looking at the skid marks on the road there, lamenting about the fact that it had rained earlier that morning and the fact that anti-lock brakes and all of these other parts of technology have made it more difficult to discern exactly what it was that might have happened. And Henry is actually leaning on his 1959 Thunderbird convertible reading from the annotated short stories. And that's how the book starts. Like, and so he has those books with him the entirety of the book. It's kind of a fun thing to work with. And then what happened was that it even had an effect on the title, because the original title for this book was called The 1% Solution, which kind of harkens back, you know, to the film. I think it was the 7% Solution, I believe it is.
Yes. Right.
In 48, the American Motorcycle Association issued a statement after the riots that were in Hollister, you know, these motorcycle riots that were in Hollister, which really weren't motorcycle riots all that much. But they issued a statement that said that only 1% of motorcyclists are this criminal element that everybody seems to, you know, want to focus on. And so, of course, you know, that 1% element took that as a badge of honor and started referring to themselves as the 1%ers. And so what I did was kind of combine the two titles, and the initial title for the book was going to be The 1% Solution. But since that kind of term is somewhat transmogrified into a political statement, you know, where the 1%ers are the 1% right. of the wealth of the United States and all this, Viking Penguin was afraid that it would be misconstrued as a political book. Okay, and so they said, well, do you think you can come up with another title? And so the first thing I did was go right back to Sherlock Holmes and that marvelous quote
there you go.
About obvious facts being just a little bit deceptive.
So, Craig, let's talk about your journey into the television world. Mm-hmm. You know, many writers love to say that they'd never sell their book to television, hoping desperately that they will.
Yeah, there seem to be an awful lot of experts out there about television that have never had anything done. You know, and it seems like, you know, yeah, they kind of like, you know, shan't, you know, they shall look away like until somebody writes them a check. And I think it is. Like, you hear a lot of the horror stories. Do what now?
Yes, of course. I was going to say, my impression is that you had a very positive experience, or are having, we should say, because now the series is going to be original productions on Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's been pretty fantastic. I mean, I was lucky enough, like, that I had a friend in Los Angeles who gave me a little bit of advice and said, you know, don't sign a blind option. Just don't, like, sign an open-ended option contract. You know, wait and see, like that, because if they want you bad enough, they will offer you a package deal where you'll get to meet the directors, you'll get to meet the producers, you'll, you know, have some say, like that, in what it is that's going on. And more important than anything else, simply because it's essential to any kind of business, is that, you know, it's easy to get optioned, but the difficulty is trying to get something made, because getting optioned is easy, but getting something made takes money. And so the difficulty there is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, you get optioned, but you end up in some manila envelope somewhere in some producer's desk, and nothing ever gets made. And for me, it's always been about, you know, the visibility for the books, an opportunity to get the books into more people's hands. Because, come on, I'm a cowboy writer in a town of 25. You know, I'm not looking to move to Los Angeles, not looking to move to New York or anything like that. I like my life the way it is. And so, you know, whenever this offer came up.
It's clearly, it must have changed your life. It must
oh,
have
yeah,
changed.
No. It's had a large-scale effect. No two ways about it. Like, I'm kind of jumping ahead there, like that. But it was one of those things where, you know, I really felt comfortable with the people that I was dealing with. Which is like the best advice, you know, that I can give out, you know, to any authors who, you know, find themselves in this position. It's a job interview, and you need to, you know, interview these people and find out and see if they really are interested in doing what it is that you're interested in doing. Like that. And Greer Shepherd, Hunt Baldwin, John Coveney, they were a really good group of producers who had a wonderful track record for actually getting things done. And, you know, that was what I thought, okay, you know, maybe this would be the direction to go in. And they seemed to have an inordinate understanding of the books and the feel and the tone of the books and all of this. And I think you kind of have to go into it, you know, with your eyes open. I think, you know, a lot of authors are disappointed with Hollywood because Hollywood doesn't, you know, do exactly what they want them to do. You know, they see their books as sort of a template, you know, for exactly what should happen. And the thing that they don't seem to understand is that this is a different art form. You know, what makes for a good book might not make for good television episodes, you know. And so one of the first meetings that I had with the producers, they said to me, they said, well, your books don't break down into a 42-minute teleplay structure very easily. And I said, thank you. I hope that's the case, because if they did, you shouldn't be reading them anyway. You know, so for me, look at it was, you know, kind of an eye-opener to see that, you know, what Hollywood is really looking for more than anything else are the characters. You know, we're in our fifth season of Longmire, you know, with both the productions, the three seasons that were in A&E, and now the two seasons that are going to be on Netflix and continue it, hopefully, on Netflix. They have 53 episodes. I've only got 12 books, you know, so it would be very difficult. Very quickly, Hollywood will go through the material of your books as far as the plots are concerned, but what they're looking for are characters that have resonance, you know, characters and, you know, relationships and, you know, a world that they can utilize, like, to continue on for years to come. And that's the tricky part of the business.
Is it interesting to see Walt, to me, he sort of lives in two parallel universes because, as you explained, it has to be a different person on TV. He's not very different, but he's different from the Walt Longmire in the books. So is that disconcerting or interesting or fun or...
Yeah, I think more interesting and fun, you know, and I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's two separate but equal universes, basically, is the way you have to look at it. And one of the things they did was is they jumped back in time, you know, because in The Cold Dish, the very first Walt Longmire book, that's like 5 or 6 years after Walt's wife has died. And one of the things they did was they went back to, it's been less than a year since Walt's wife died, whenever the television series starts. And that kind of gives a different kind of a feel to who Walt is. You know, he hasn't had quite the amount of time to get over, one of the biggest, you know, I guess, crises and disappointments in his life, you know, the death of his wife. And, you know, I think that, you know, you have to be open to the idea that, you know, that these are ideas that are going to go places and do things. One of the first big altercations that I had with the producers was when they were doing the casting for Walt and Henry. They said, well, we think we're going to make Walt and Henry about 10 years younger than they are in your books. And I had the immediate redneck cowboy author response where I was like, well, now why are we doing that? And they said, well, because we'd really like the show to run for about 10 years, and we'd rather not have Walt and Henry on walkers by the time we get to the end of it. And, you know, I had a hard time arguing with that. I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So here we are in our fifth season and hoping for 5 more.
All of us are hoping for 5 more. I want to go back to the book for a second, though. In some of the promotional material, you've always been interested in motorcycles since, as I read, your dad rebuilt, was it an Indian?
Yes, it was. I always wonder if anybody reads those forewords, if anybody reads those things. Like, and evidently you did. So,
well,
yeah.
You know.
It's been a lifelong fascination. I mean, I like anything. Like, you know, I just was down at the barn, like, talking to the horses, like, before I came back up for the interview, like that, you know. And, yeah, I got 4 motorcycles sitting down there in the shop, you know, and I've got, you know, a couple of old pickup trucks and a couple of old cars, like, that I'm rebuilding, like, and so, yeah, it's a lifelong fascination for me of taking things apart and putting them back together and see if I can get them to go faster. But, yeah, that kind of got handed down from my father, who rebuilt an old Indian motorcycle from about 16 peach baskets, you know, full of parts. And evidently it made a large-scale impression on me at a very impressionable age. That's something that Walt and I don't share, like that, which is, you know, kind of a fun thing to do. I mean, not always does your protagonist, and the writer agree on certain things, you know. And Walt's, you know, career in law enforcement, you know, is as many traffic stops as he's made, as many accidents as he's had to report on, and all of this. He's not a big fan of motorcycles, and so to find himself in the middle of one of the largest motorcycle rallies in the world is, you know, kind of puts him in an off footing, as it were.
But I think it's the first time we really see Henry riding a motorcycle, and not just one motorcycle. He's got 2 on this trip.
He does. It was kind of interesting to me to put the history of the Sturgis motorcycle rally in there, and the Jack Pine Gypsies hill climb, which was the individuals who kind of started off. And that's kind of one of the fun aspects of the books, is that, you know, you get to include some of the oddball and strange aspects of history in the places that you're writing about. And, in this book we get to learn a lot more about Henry and his past, and most importantly, his romantic past.
I know, we meet Lola.
I know. Yeah, she cuts a pretty wide swath in this book. In some ways, you know, she might hearken, you know, to a Sherlock Holmes character that I'm sure Leslie's aware of, like that is a little bit of that femme fatale kind of character, but still, you know, very alluring, like that, and very intelligent, you know, and very capable.
Irene Adler.
She's Henry Standing Bear's Irene Adler. And you also have, and you mentioned it, you have the Devil's Monument, and somehow you managed to have that be a looming presence in the book without mentioning that movie, in which it was also a looming presence in the book.
Yeah, I don't know. There are some parts of popular culture that are like too strong to even bring into it, you know. And so if I'd done anything about encounters of the whatever kind like that, I'm afraid that it might have like overshadowed, you know, a lot of the plot lines of the book. Okay? And I don't know. For me, you know, the actual native history of Devil's Tower was, you know, even more interesting than, you know, than the cinematic history of it. To discover that the general who first discovered Devil's Tower, his interpreter got it wrong. They got the title of it wrong, where it was misinterpreted as Bad God's Tower, which they interpreted as meaning Devil's Tower, as what it, you know, what it meant, when it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the actual translation of the title of the geographic area at all. Like, and so, and then the battles that have been going on politically, like that, where they want to return it back to the Bear Lodge, like that, and, you know, in which tribes it is that should have, you know, control over what name it should be brought back to, and then the political maneuverings, you know, within the state of Wyoming to make sure that it stayed Devil's Tower so people would remember it and it could remain a tourist site and not be confusing for tourists. And so, you know, for me, those are the kind of social histories that I enjoy, maybe even more than the cinematic.
So, Craig, how much time do you end up spending on the TV series?
Whenever they get into production, you know, it's always a little bit, you know, more hectic. It's kind of a mildly controlled natural disaster that goes on, you know, pretty much from March all the way through June.
Right.
And they film it down in New Mexico because, you know, of course, the weather patterns are a little bit more stable down in New Mexico than they are here in Wyoming. And generally what I do is I go down and visit, you know, and I'm on set. I'll meet with the producers, you know, on the off season, where they'll give me an indication of, like, you know, what it is they're planning, what they're thinking about, you know, where the arc of the characters and the arc of the storylines are going to go out there in Los Angeles. And then at the beginning of the filming, I'll go down on set just to meet and hook up, you know, with the cast and the crew and everybody, because they've all actually become, you know, pretty good friends. Like, they're all, you know, pretty wonderful people. And, you know, they all, majority of them actually come up to Longmire Days here in Buffalo, Wyoming, a little town of 4,000 people. I go down for the beginning of the season, get, you know, get, kind of, you know, hook up with everybody, talk with them and everything. And then when they start production, they send me the scripts, you know, for each one of the episodes every week or every 2 weeks as we go. Look at it, and then I give them feedback on, you know, what I think. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree.
Lou Diamond Phillips is a special. We have a connection. He came to my daughter's wedding. His manager.
Oh my!
His manager is my son-in-law. So.
Oh, okay. I had no idea. Like, yeah, he's just an absolute charmer. He's just an amazing individual, like that, and he's actually a ferocious reader too, like that, which is really kind of nice. You know, we've got a very intelligent cast, like that, that actually reads, like that, and not in Hollywood is that always the case, like that. But whenever Lou actually was trying out for the role of Henry Standing Bear, he actually went out and bought the first three novels and read them over the weekend before he came in to do his audition. And what was interesting was, is in the audition piece, like at, I got to see the audition piece, and, you know, and they sent me the DVDs, you know, for the auditions for the actors that they were looking at, and I got the DVD from Lou, and I remember watching it. And in the audition piece, there was a monologue that had three contractions in it: an isn't, a wasn't, and a don't. And when Lou did the audition, he took the contractions out, and I thought, he's read my books. Because in the books, Henry doesn't use any contractions, and sure enough, that's exactly what it was that he had done. He had gone out and, you know, and read the first three books in the series.
That's impressive.
He knew that character pretty well by the time he came into audition.
So, are you planning anything non Longmire?
Oh yeah, I've got a couple of different pieces that I've actually started. I've got a psychological thriller that I'm about, I don't know, maybe 2/3 of the way through. I've got a period Western that I'm wanting to, you know, to write. I've got a literary fiction piece that I'm wanting to write. I've got stuff, you know, it's all these like ideas stored away like that. But, you know, I got to admit that the wall books tend to get in the way simply because I enjoy writing them. I'm still having such a blast, you know, writing them. You know, being with a literary press, they don't put any pressure on me about what I want to write about or how I want to write it or anything. And, you know, I have a lot of freedom in the Walt books, you know, to take on different social issues, to move the books around to different locations and deal with different plot situations like that, and, you know, develop the characters. And so that kind of freedom is, you know, is intoxicating. It's turned out to be a blast. You know, so
well, it's
I'm having more fun writing the 12th book than I did the first. So
that's enviable, Craig, because too often series writers start to feel the trap. They start to feel like, you know, there's economic pressure, the family is counting on them, et cetera, and they just, you know, it becomes a chore.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the individuals that the Hallmarks that we were speaking about earlier got a little bit tired of one of his characters.
Dee Dee did. And, you know, I'm just in awe of guys like Michael Connelly, you know, who can turn out high quality, you know, maybe even two books a year. But I mean, wow, mm-hmm. just to kill. But you and I both have friends who have bailed because they just hated the treadmill.
Yeah. It's a difficult situation to be in like that because, I mean, you do sometimes become, you know, like I said, encapsulated, you know, by your own success like that. But I think you just kind of have to approach each one and know that, you know, I mean, each one is going to be different, you know, and there's always, you know, going to be readers that'll write me and say, I really hated your last book. And I'm always writing the back and going, don't worry, the next book is completely different. You know, that's, you know, part of the job, I think. You know, you kind of have to risk it a little bit to try and do things that are a little bit different. I mean, the seventh book that I wrote, Hell is Empty, like that was a, you know, an analogous retelling of Dante's Inferno, for gosh sakes, you know, up in the Cloud Peak Wilderness area. And there were a lot of people that wrote me and said, I really didn't like that book. You know, and now, you know, a number of years have gone by, and they write me back and go, you know what, I reread that book. You know what, I really like that book. Okay. And so, you know, for me, it's an opportunity to try and do something different, you know, and you just wait and see what the response is going to be. But, you know, you really can't be responsible for that response. You have to go ahead and move on, you know, with what it is that, you know, challenges you and makes you feel good as a writer and feel as though you're, you know, you're expanding your abilities and trying to do something different.
I think that's really well said, Craig. The great writers all have agreed with you. You don't write for the audience, you write for yourself.
Yeah. I think, you know, because, you know, you're there in the room by yourself, you know, you hope, you know, that they'll respond and you hope that they'll enjoy, you hope that it'll, you know, instigate some thought, you know, process and all of these things. But in the final analysis, you are alone in the room by yourself with your imaginary friends. And, you know, you're kind of on your own at that point in time to see what happens.
And they're fantastic imaginary friends. I can imagine that you have tremendous conversations.
I try not to do that. Like, you know, I try not to talk to them too much whenever they're not in the books. Like, and I've got some theories on that, too. Like, these are my psychological theories on that. You know, you hear a lot of times authors will talk about how, you know, oh, the characters just speak to me and they just start talking. And it's kind of like the armed man kind of routine, too. Like, I don't know about you guys, like, but people who sit in rooms by themselves and hear voices kind of worry me a little bit. I think what the reasoning behind that is that it's that improvisational aspect of the writing process that is really where the fun begins, you know, because you sit down and you do outlines and you do the research and you have all of this material to work with and you plan it all out and you start off and then something happens that you didn't really plan on, or the characters say things that you didn't really count on. Well, I don't really think that that's, you know, some ethereal, you know, characters hovering around your head that are looking for an opportunity or anything like that. All it really is your subconscious mind. You know, your conscious mind is responsible for having the fingers on the keyboard. It's the one that's getting the research books out. It's the one that's doing all the factual work like that, you know. But your poor subconscious is kind of like a backseat driver. You know, it's back there and can't have its hands on the wheel or the accelerator or the brake or anything. But just like any other backseat driver, it's going to throw something over the seat every once in a while. And I think that's, you know, that's where the writing gets fun, you know, because your psychology, you know, the psychology of, you know, your subconscious mind, you know, is going to have an effect on, you know, what directions it's going to go in, because it might know a little bit something more than your conscious mind actually does.
Right. Janet Ivanovich reportedly said, was asked about what happens when her characters start going in directions that she didn't anticipate. She says, I shoot him in the back.
That's tough, like, because you can lose a lot of characters that way.
That's true.
You're about to start on a monster book tour. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at it. You're essentially going everywhere.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, from the beginning, like that, I always made it clear to Viking Penguin that, you know, that I didn't mind, you know, going out and hitting the road like that. It's one of the joys, I think, you know, of what it is that we do. And, you know, in a time period, you know, where the economics of the situation and, you know, the number of bookstores, you know, that are actually out there that can support, you know, these type of events, I'm very fortunate. I'm very lucky to have, you know, a publisher and a reading public like that, you know, that wants to see me like it. And so for me, this is a wonderful opportunity to get out and actually get to talk with people who've read the books. I mean, the writing is always going to be number one. That's always going to be the most enjoyable aspect of it. You know, whenever I'm doing writing classes and teaching workshops, and young writers want to know what it's like to go out and have a beer with Lou Diamond Phillips, you know, or hang around on set, or, you know, get a feature piece done, you know, in a major newspaper or things like that. I'm always like, you do know that that's only like 5% of what my life is, that the other 95% is sitting on a chair, looking at a blank screen and summoning up words. You know, that's what you're really going to be doing 95% of the time. And, you know, the other small portion of it is, though, in that 5% is the tour, to be able to go out and meet the people who have, you know, been reading your books, you know, and get the responses for them and see what they think. And you know, it's a blast to actually do that. I have a wonderful time doing it. This tour will be about 3.5, coming up on 4 weeks, I think it is, bouncing around all over the country. And then, you know, the books have been translated into about, you know, a dozen languages, and so there are a number of foreign tours that I do on an annual basis. You know, the books are big hits in France, and so generally I do about 2 tours a year in France, which really got my street cred up here around the ranch when I started taking my wife Judy to Paris twice a year.
Of all the countries in Europe, France is that's a bit of a surprise to me, at least.
You're telling me. That was a really big surprise. I mean, if somebody would have said, okay, you know, your stories about this sheriff in the least populated county, least populated state, are going to be runaway hits in a foreign country, maybe France wouldn't have been the first guess that I would have made. You know, it's been kind of interesting, but I think what they've responded to a great deal is the characters, the intricacy of characters. And then, you know, the other aspect of it is always going to be, as far as, you know, foreign translations are concerned, is how good of a translation do you get? I mean, if you get a really good translation, you get a good book. If you get a bad translation, you get a bad book. And so you kind of live or die by the translator who does your books. And I've got this amazing woman by the name of Sophia Slanides, like, who translates my books and has even come over and actually spent a month over here at the ranch just kind of getting a feel, you know, for, you know, what, you know, Wyoming was like, and, you know, a feel for up on the reservation, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and all of that. And she's an absolutely marvelous translator, like that, and a pretty magnificent publisher. Those help, too.
Well, I could see that the appeal would also be that Walt is very philosophical, and the French like philosophical.
I thought you were going to say
it's kind of funny.
No,
a lot of times whenever I'm traveling
to
the U.S., you know what the response I get will be, you know, boy, Walt sure seems smart for a Wyoming sheriff. And I'm always like, I don't know which part of that I'm going to take umbrage with first, the fact that he's from Wyoming or that he's a sheriff. So, but yeah, he is. I mean, he's a very intelligent, you know, world-class detective. Very much so. Like in the third book, you know, he kind of goes head to head with the Philadelphia Police Department in a homicide investigation, and kind of, you know, proves the fact that he is a world class detective. He just happens to live in a low density population based area.
He's a graduate of USC.
He is a graduate of USC. Like, I get that question an awful lot of the time. Like, people always ask me. They say, "Well, how did this guy, you know, from Wyoming, you know, end up at USC?" Like, and my immediate response is, it was the 60s. Where would you go? Lincoln, Nebraska? You know, come on. You'd go to California. You know, I've got this image of Walt, you know, in a Mustang convertible driving up and down the 101, you know, in the 1960s, you know. But before, you know, the federal government sent him a little letter, you know, and he graduated and lost his deferment and had an all-expense-paid trip to Vietnam. which kind of like changed the trajectory of his life a great deal. But yeah, it just, you know, it was all part of that that aspect of trying to broaden, you know, Walt's horizons. Like that I didn't want him, you know, to simply be from, you know, this this small, you know, area, had grown up here, went to school here, stayed here. I wanted him to have, you know, some world experiences to draw from. And he was a very good offensive tackle. Like, and so, you know, he got picked up by USC like that, and it kind of changed his life a little bit.
Well, is there anything that we should talk about, Craig, that we didn't talk about?
No, I'm just, you know, I'm just delighted to be able to speak with you like that, because it was whenever I was putting this book together, all I could think was, I said, I got to use Les's book. I've got to have Les's book in this book.
Well, you know,
because
it's
just a wonderful opportunity.
Always happy to be a technical advisor.
Well, and you joined some good ranks like that, because, you know, I think some of the other authors that I've used have been Shakespeare and Dante and Dickens, wow, you know, and all of these other, like, wow, and it just seemed like, you know, I should put you up there into that Hall of Fame. So there you are, my friend.
I'll be looking for a spike in sales as soon as you're successful.
Absolutely.
Great.
Great.
Nancy, anything else?
No, I just wanted to thank Craig for joining us, and you know, wish him a lot of luck on the tour. I'm looking forward
Absolutely.
To the next
You're
book.
Absolutely, you're
gonna have a great tour. Absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much for the opportunity to be on the show. Like, this has been a blast. I knew it would be, and it's turned out to be just as I thought it would be. So, thank you so much.